Thank you for downloading the State of the Art 2017 podcast. Look us up at soa.ics.ac.uk and join us in Westminster from December the 10th to the 12th, 2018.
So I think in the next few minutes I'm going to talk about high flow nasal, and I'm Luigi Camporotta. I work at St. Thomas's Hospital in the intensive care. And what I thought we'll do in the next few minutes, we'll talk about the physiology of high flow and then how we use in intensive care. So the pre-intubation, we'll see what happens in some patients with hypercapnia, and then in the post-extubation. How does that sound? Okay. So I think it's probably quite useful to define what is high flow. I find this quite helpful because it just says that is the provision of a totally conditioned gas. By gas, we mean oxygen and air. And obviously, the oxygen varies from air sort of 21% to 100%, is warmed and is humidified and has got that content of water, which is 44 milligrams of water per litre, which is 100% relative humidity. And that's quite important. Of the flow between 0 and 60 litres. Is it something that you are familiar with that concept, I'm sure? So I'd like to sort of break down the physiology, how high flow works, in a series of steps. So the first one, we know about that high flow lowers the dilution of administered oxygen. So what do we mean? So if you look, I've got a pointer here, so it's really good. So if you look on your left-hand side, so this is the flow, inspiratory and the expiratory flow. So this is a patient breathing 100% oxygen, but through a nasal cannulae at 4 litres per minute, okay? So if the peak inspiratory flow is about 40 litres or 35 litres, that means that 4 litres of the inspiratory flow is provided at 100%, and the rest is air. So then the final oxygen will be a combination of the litres per minute that is at air, 21%, plus the 4 litres of 1. So the final FiO2 is never defined, never set. Whereas on the high flow, for example here, 35 or 40 litres, then it can match completely the inspiratory flow. And so the FiO2, the final FiO2, is equal to the administered FiO2. And that's why you can maintain the FiO2 that you set, because essentially you provide the FiO2 with the entire inspiratory flow. And I think that's important. The second effect is the conditioned gas, so heated and humidified. Now, I've been through some old stuff, and by old, you know, in 1996, it's not that old, but it's still very, very relevant. And I've redrew that for you, because if you think that one is the resistance of the airway, and by resistance in the nose and the proximal airway, and you can see this is the temperature and this is the resistance. You can see as the temperature is dropped, the resistance goes up. And it's a very common feeling. You've got cold air, there is osmoreceptors, bronchoconstrictions, and some people get asthma because of that. But essentially, the resistance in the upper airway, even if we don't have asthma or bronchial responsiveness, the resistance goes up. And the same thing, if the humidity goes down, so dry air, the resistance goes up. And as the humidity goes up, the resistance goes down. So just by the fact of having a warm and humidified gas, then we can decrease the resistance. And that's very important because it's to do with work of breathing, as we will see later on. Now, who likes maths? No one. But I found this fascinating. I'll see whether you agree with me. Forget about the formula, but well, let's the concept. So the concept is that if we inspire cold and dry air, we need to spend energy to make it warm and humidified. The question is how much energy? Now, this is the energy that we need to warm and humidify 1 liter of gas, okay? So we need some energy to warm it, so to go from ambient temperature to 37 degrees, plus we need some energy to add water, to make it humidified. And this is the amount of water that there is in the atmosphere minus, well, the one that we need to get to 44 milligrams. So what it works out is that we need 26 calories per liter of air. So if we breathe half a liter total volume, 12 times a minute, we need 156 calories a minute just to warm it. Okay, so you can imagine someone has got an oxygen deficiency, lactate is up, work of breathing is up, VO2 is up. Then this is the amount of work that they need to generate in order to just warm and humidify air. Okay, and it is more comfortable to breathe high flow. Now, in white is the high flow, in yellow is the non-invasive ventilation. That's the PF ratio. And that's the visual analog score for dyspnea. The lower, the better. So you can see that high flow is much more comfortable compared to non-invasive ventilation. Although, when you look at the PF ratio, clearly non-invasive ventilation is better, but you will see later on that is better in terms of PF ratio, but then because the tolerance is reduced, don't keep it very long. And so you go up and down on the PF ratio and up and down on the comfort score. So we looked at humidified and metabolic cost and FiO2. What about CO2 clearance? I don't know, how many people use it for COPD? Have you ever used? Yeah, well, that's very good. Quite a few. I too use it. And one of the things is that I find this one very interesting. So this is see how the clearance rate of air using high flow. So in a way, how can we completely wash out the upper airway and reduce rebreathing in order to decrease the carbon dioxide? So this is an interesting study that basically shows that if you increase the nasal high flow from 15 liters to 45, you've got a certain clearance of the gas in the upper airways. And you can see that you can clear 1.8 milliliters per second per liter of flow. What it means that if we think our nasal cavity is about 55 milliliters, means that a 30 litres nasal high flow, it will take you only 1 second to clear the dead space. And that's quite an important point. So this is if you take patients with stable COPD, so it means not an acute exacerbation, and you look at the PCO2, this is spontaneous breathing, about 55 millimetre of mercury. High flow is almost the equivalent to non-invasive ventilation in terms of reducing the carbon dioxide. And it works through that mechanism. This is a busy one, but I will simplify for you. Basically, these are patients with COPD. And what you can see is that this is the transcutaneous CO2. So you look at the gray bars. Basically, the control in COPD, they'll go down. The saturation remains the same. The minute ventilation goes down, the total volume goes down, the respiratory rates stay the same. So what I'm trying to say is that despite the fact the minute ventilation goes down, the total volume goes down, still this patient managed to clear CO2 better. And I think the reason is the combination of what we said, reduce dead space, wash out, reduce rebreathing, and the resistance of the upper airways. So this is a study that was published in Thorax last year. And you can see these are transcutaneous CO2, respiratory rate, LTOT, and high flow. So the CO2 goes down, the respiratory rate goes down. The total volume goes up, so some patients have a slower and deeper breathing, and the end expiratory lung volume goes up. So there is an EPEEP effect. Then some patients' COPD might help dynamic hyperinflation and actually might help emptying of the airways and the lung parenchyma, and that's why sometimes you can see that increase in total volume. So the other thing that we all know is that high-flow nasal cannula produces PEEP effect. And I'm going to show you that. It's essentially an airway pressure at zero, so just oxygen, and that is at high flow. what you can see that this is a flow dependent. So as you increase the flow, the pressure goes up. You can see that linearly related. And I want to show you that as a study that basically is they've gone from 0 to 100 liters of flow. And you can see that 100 liters per minute, I never tried, it must be an experience, you can get a positive end expiratory pressure almost of 12 centimeters of water. So you can see this is a bit varied, but let's say between 0.8 and 1 centimeters of water per 10 liters of flow. Obviously depends. If you open your mouth, pressure will go down on average by 2 centimeters of water. If you breathe with your with the mouth closed, then this is closer to that number over there. But I find this very interesting because some people compare it with CPAP. High flow is not CPAP, and I want to show you why it's so different from CPAP. So think about this is CPAP 5, okay? So this is flow, inspiration on your left, expiration on your right, and then you've got airway pressure just there on the y-axis, okay? Now, CPAP is the one at the top. So that's 5 centimeters of water, which is constant throughout inspiration and expiration. But look at this. This is control. So when we breathe from zero to minus flow, so inspiration, our airway pressure goes down, which is normal because air needs to go from the ambient temperature to the alveoli following a negative pressure. So that goes down. And then on expiration is almost zero. As you increase the high flow, you can see that the inspiratory pressure is still a little bit negative unless you go 50 to 60 liters. But the PEEP, so the positive end expiratory pressure, can approach or even be higher than CPAP. So there is a differential pressure between inspiration and expiration. And sometimes this can be associated with less work of breathing on inspiration, depending on the lung mechanics. Does it make sense, the difference between high flow and CPAP? I found that quite interesting. And essentially, this is a busy, but to say that high flow at different rates will decrease the respiratory rate, will increase the tidal volume, which in a way that is flow dependent. And this is a little bit more physiological, but if you don't like graphs and you ignore the top part, I've simplified that to the bottom. And essentially, you can see masks, so oxygen and high flow. This is the delta esophageal pressure. So the greater the delta, the more effort the patient is making. And you can see that that goes down by about 2 centimeters of water, which is important, it's about 20% reduction. The pressure time product, which is sort of a measure of work of breathing, goes down. The PF ratio goes up. Now, this is a mean of ventilation, goes down. So patient is more comfortable. They don't need to breathe so hard because they feel the inspiratory flow and the expiratory flow are maintained. And there is a relative increase of end expiratory lung volume, so the PEEP effect. And this is the same thing, but it shows in COPD during sleep. So some patients have been using high flow instead of an IV during sleep. And you can see the work of breathing as they sleep goes down compared to room air or oxygen. Pressure time product decreases and the pressure swings in the esophageal. So it seems to be a fairly constant thing in COPD and in patients with respiratory failure. And I found that also quite interesting because we've started using in ICU this, particularly sometimes in some of the patients on ECMO, and they are extubated. So we use high flow as a way of exercising them and allow some physiotherapy. And you can see that, for example, these are patients who have been exercised, submaximal exercise. This is a dyspnea score. This is a leg discomfort score, and this is the saturation. So you can see this one here, the one open, is high flow. So you can the other way around. This is the oxygen, and this is the high flow. You can see the dyspnea score is lower on high flow, and they feel less leg pain. So the idea that they can utilize oxygen much better, and the saturation has improved. I'll skip this one because I don't like it. It's a bit busy for now, for the morning, too early. So, well, let's talk about, so we've looked at the physiological effect, how it can help oxygenation, worker breathing, and carbon dioxide removal. But let's go closer to the ICU. So we've got patients with hypoxemic respiratory failure. We want to have a look at the intubation rate and mortality. So this is one of the studies that I think probably the first of its kind, 2015 New England Journal Floralis study. So patients on hypoxemic respiratory failure without any history of cardiovascular disease or COPD, and they received either high-flow oxygen, standard oxygen, or non-invasive ventilation. Now, when you look at the table for the overall trial, it doesn't look too impressive. Its numbers are very nice, but you see the intubation rate is 38% on the high flow. They go up to 50% in the non-invasive ventilation. But you can see that the test is not statistically significant. But when you look at patients with PF ratio, so the more severe PF ratio, less than 200, then the high flow has got, sorry, the standard oxygen is 2.14 times more likely to achieve intubation, so to fail, compared to high flow. And non-invasive ventilation has got an intubation or a failure of treatment, which is 2.6 times higher than high flow. So in the PF ratio less than 200, high flow seems to be the best of the three options. And this is also true when you look at other patients, more specialized patients with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure, for example, immunocompromised. And we have got a lot, at St. Thomas, a lot of immunocompromised. We've got the hematology, we've got the lupus unit. So lots of patients come to us with already immunocompromised. And you can see this nice sort of Kaplan-Meier curve that high flow nasal cannula achieves a better survival rate. And you can see the intubation is much less than the non-invasive ventilation. Mortality is half. Application, this is quite important, I think achieves what high flow wants to achieve. That is well tolerated, so patients keep it continuously, whereas non-invasive ventilation is on and off, and the majority, well, on average, can be kept just for about 8 hours a day, and the rest, and sometimes discontinuous. You can see that only 13% needed rescue non-invasive ventilation. You can see mortality, and the mortality if intubated, this is quite interesting. So if patients fail non-invasive ventilation and get intubated, had 70% mortality. If they failed high-flow nasal cannula, 43%. Okay, so it's not thousands of patients trial, but it's quite interesting because it follows what we see in clinical practice. And then if you see there what are the factors associated with intubation, so presence of NIV will increase 3.25 times chances of getting intubated, and vasopressors, so being in shock, about 4 times, and similar thing are associated with mortality plus the age. This is, do you remember the Floralis study I showed earlier on? So this is a subgroup analysis of immunocompromised patients. And essentially you see the same thing. High flow, better than oxygen, better than non-invasive ventilation. And this is in terms of intubation, and the same thing in reverse is for survival. And you can see roughly there is a consistency among the studies where age and the presence of NIV are associated with greater mortality. So if you look at, I've looking at all the meta-analyses, there are quite a few meta-analyses that all include the same studies, they all give different results. And I think the reason why they give different results is because they include studies with different type of outcomes. For example, I'll show you the two different meta-analyses. So this one is looking at high flow, oxygen or NIV before intubation. So the patients have never been intubated before. They come through the unit fresh, and then they are randomized for one of these three treatments. And you can see that high flow is always associated with best outcome in terms of reintubation or ICU mortality, so it's below one, so favors high flow nasal cannulin. Now this one, probably the red is not the most visible color in the world, but essentially this one looks at acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. So some of them are post-extubation, some of them are pre-intubation, so it's a bit of a mix, and you can see the results are a little bit different. And so that's why I will encourage you, when you look at meta-analysis, to look precisely what were the indication of the study included. So you can see there's still very good compared to oxygen, but is equivalent to non-invasive ventilation. But that is because it includes different studies. So far we've seen high flow is a reduction in intubation and failure rate, but it's important that we monitor failure. So this is a study that shows that if the respiratory rate is up, and there is thoracoabdominal asynchrony, and by that we mean sort of use of accessory muscles, paradoxic breathing, labored breathing. It essentially is an assessment of work of breathing. You can see, although the thoracoabdominal asynchrony goes down, so as a percentage of patients, the one who fail, there's a big difference, so they're still associated with greater risk of failure if you see a patient with thoracoabdominal asynchrony, 30 minutes, 1 hour, and 2 hours. And how many people have seen this ROCS score? I think it's quite interesting. So this is looking at SpO2-FiO2 ratio divided by the respiratory rate. So you can see the greater the ROCS score, the better the outcome, and the lower the ROCS score, the worse the outcome. So if you look at 2 hours and 12 hours, if this is consistently low, you need to reassess, because the chances of failure are high. And if they are higher, we don't do anything, we let patients unintubated for very long, their outcome is very different. So you can see ICU mortality 39%. If we recognize failure and we act on it, or if we don't recognize and we don't do anything about it, we let the patient deteriorate. So 66% mortality versus 39. And they've got 1 in 3 that get cardiac dysfunction ICU compared to 10%. So I think it's quite important. And ventilation-free days, you can see there is a 40% relative risk reduction in ventilator-free days. So this is my own, so I'll take full responsibility for it. But essentially, the way I think about this is, if you see a patient with acute respiratory failure, think about, do they need to be clearly intubated immediately? If so, just do it. If not, think, is this a patient with a de novo respiratory failure, i.e. a young patient with pneumonia, for example, never had COPD or any sort of cardiac or respiratory insufficiency? High flow nasal cannula would be my first, warmed, humidified, and the flow titrated to comfort. So we use quite a lot of visual analog score. I'll show you some of the results later on, where you say to the patient, how do you feel, 1 to 10? What about 20, 30, 40? Because it changes over time. So titrate, and then look at hemodynamics, thoracoabdominal asynchrony, PF ratio, or SpO2, FiO2 ratio, ROCS are 2 and 12 hours. And then think, is there a clinical improvement? Yes, continue. No, obviously, I think this is important. Whereas if you've got a patient with COPD or pulmonary edema, then you may consider non-invasive ventilation. And then we often rotate it with high flow, so the patient can cough, can have a physio session, can eat, can drink, can feel human again, and then rotate as a rotating strategy. So the other use is clearly post-extubation. Now, this is a sort of overall study that was published think in 2014 in the Blue Journal, and these are all patients who have been extubated with acute respiratory failure with a PF ratio less than 300. So they've been intubated on average about 5 days. And you can see they looked at desaturations compared to oxygen. So they're fewer, 0.8 episode per patient compared to 3.4. Fewer displacements, so patient pulling out the interface. They needed fewer respiratory support because of acute respiratory failure. Intubation was less than 4%. They needed fewer sort of episodes of non-invasive ventilation, and the discomfort was much less than non-invasive ventilation. So when you look at normally the way we conceptualize patients post-extubation, is this, we do an SBT. How many people do SBTs? Quite a few. So this is quite an interesting data that I pulled together from various trials. It looks like if you do an SBT and a patient develops, so doesn't develop hypercapnia, usually there is no difference between non-invasive ventilation and oxygen. But if they do develop, then NIV is a good option, because in that case, the reintubation is much lower than non-invasive ventilation compared to standard. And for patients who get reintubated, then clearly the mortality is higher compared to the ones who don't get reintubated. So the importance of preventing reintubation is very important, and NIV will do that. And this is a recent one study where if you've got patients with these characteristics, high risk of failure, and which are basically the one in blue, so high risk versus low risk, the dotted line, and you give them non-invasive ventilation, you reduce the risk of reintubation from 28 to 15%. So that's quite significant, and I'll tell you how it joins together with the high flow in a second. Because when you look at this trial last year, comparing high flow versus oxygen, then there is a low risk of extubations, the one I showed you earlier on, then obviously high flow is much better than oxygen, okay? And we know that there is a reduction in reintubation, post-extubation failure, etc. The same thing with post-abdominal surgery. You know, I don't know whether your surgeons are happy to have CPAP or non-invasive ventilation in patients with upper GI surgery. Ours are not very keen, but that is you can see there is an improvement in discomfort, but not very much difference in terms of post-op hypoxemia. And certainly, do you remember I was talking about how the NIV is very important, reduces the reintubation? Well, this has been compared, NIV versus high flow, and actually they are equivalent. The one in blue means there's statistically no difference between the two groups. So there's no difference in treatment failure. There is no treatment difference in mortality, reintubation rate, but clearly there is less skin breakdown and premature discontinuation, so patients don't tolerate it. So that is a valid alternative to patients who you think NIV might not be appropriate or not tolerated. And you can see the same thing here in patients at high risk. So equivalence between non-invasive ventilation and high flow. These are about 500 patients in total, 19% reintubation, which I think is quite within the range of the literature. There are some recent studies that go even higher, but reintubation all cause about 20%. No difference between the two groups. But there is less post-extubation respiratory rate. This is in white, so statistically significant. No difference in reintubation rate. The hypercapnia, this is very interesting. Although the numbers are small, but you can see that there is less hypercapnia in the high flow, although it's not statistically significant. You would expect the opposite. And I think the reason for that is that patients on high flow, they keep it, whereas the non-invasive ventilation, CO2 might go down, back up again when they eat, go down again. And you can see everything else is roughly the same. But this is, if you think about from a patient perspective, having 43% adverse event versus zero, think it makes it quite clear what they prefer. And this is something that we have done. So these are patients who've been during an SBT. So we do 0 and 0, so no pressure support, no PEEP, TPs. And basically what we do, we extubate the patient. They pass the SBT first, then extubate, and then we go from 10 to 60 liters of high flow. And we'll say, how do you feel? And they mark. And we look at visual analog score. And you could see there is a clear difference. This is patients overall. There's a clear difference between 20 liters and 60 liters and 40 liters. So anything between 30 and 40 liters for a patient ready to be extubated seems to be maximum comfort. So, sorry?
Sorry, I was just going to ask what you class as a spontaneous breathing trial?
I was just saying 0 and 0, so TPs. So essentially we keep them intubated. No, pressure support 0. PEEP 0. We'll do it for half an hour. And I'll show you later on one thing that I think is interesting. So you can see between 30 and 40, they've 9 comfort score. But as you go down on the high flow, some patients will find it less comfortable than being at lower flow. So just be mindful that everyone is slightly different. And you can see, I put there in dots there, some of the studies, they use fixed flow, 60 litre, 50 litre, 40 and 30. And you can see the one in dots in red are the one have not particularly shown any difference in outcome, like the OPERA trial. And maybe you wonder whether that... that 8% failure rate was to do with the fact the flow might be too high for some patients. And this is one of the things we do. Essentially, what we do, we measure the peak inspiratory flow and the mean inspiratory flow during an SBT. And you can see that if a patient has a mean inspiratory flow of 40 litres, the best tolerated is going to be 40 litres post-extubation. So without doing the visual analog score, you can measure that with any ventilator and then transition them straight into the same flow and the high flow. But you can see some patients really like the 60. Some patients need 30 or 40. So you cannot tell. And so if you look at the post-extubation, this is a summary slide, you can see that overall, better than oxygen, equivalent to NIV, and the ICU mortality doesn't change. Don't forget that some of these trials were not powered to have ICU mortality. So I'm going to conclude by saying that just we need to assess the likelihood of failure when we give high-flow nasal cannulae or non-invasive ventilation. I think given the comfort, that should be an N in there, and seem to be superior to oxygen and non-invasive ventilation, acute respiratory failure. Think about early intubation in failing patients, this backwards and forwards between high flow and non-invasive ventilation, CPAP, sometimes delays things. And I think there are very good options, sometimes in rotation, for post-extubation in patients at lower risk and high risk. And I thank you for your attention, and I'll take any questions. Any questions? SBT. yeah, Rachel.
So I don't know how much you use it with EDAC patients, high flow nasal cannula.
Yeah.
But this was an incidental finding, just for some of the difficulty with tracheal patients.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know this, but about 25-30% of all COPD nasal patients have EDAC.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I've not included any study on the tracheostomy just for sake of time, but I think you're right. We use this as a bridge and as an intermediate step. Is that what you do?
Well, I don't really, but it was just this incidental time, and I just wonder whether the effects of pharyngeal,
yeah,
like you said,
yeah. I think it's very, we use it as a bridge. We use it for patient tracheostomy. We find that when they have cuff down, for example, it's quite useful. And as you say, an intermediate bridge to decannulation as well. Yeah. as the default option. I think it's so easy to administer, whether trachea or high or nasal. And sometimes, even with a tracheostomy and cuff down, we use it nasal, high flow, not in the on the tracheostomy, but nasal, just to get a normal flow through the nose and the upper airway. And some patients really like that normal sensation, and use just the tracheostomy for secretion clearance until they are ready to be decannulated. Yeah. It's a good point. There are two studies, I think. One that shows is great, and the one that shows no difference. And the way, if you look at the studies, the difference is the severity of patients. So if you've got patients who are stable, you do routine intubation, high flow is great. But if you have critically ill patients with hypoxemia, it doesn't seem to change the desaturation rate. What I normally do is this. If the patient is on high flow, pre-intubation, and they're going to be intubated, I leave them on. If they're not on, I won't start it, because I think timing is important. And in terms of desaturation, if you're in the ICU, things are normally quite well controlled, and it just stops from having other adjuncts and things they're using for a very short period of time. Yeah. Any other questions? Any controversial issues on the diagram? Yeah? Yeah. So that is one of the things that you need to judge with the flow. So the PEEP, okay, so COPD, they've got a certain amount of dynamic hyperinflation normally. Now, COPD, contrary to the asthma patients, will benefit with a little bit of external PEEP. But the question is, you're quite right, you can give too much. But they will tell you, because they'll feel uncomfortable. You start having forced expiration, because they are defending the lung volume. That is the only way what you can do. You just decrease the flow, because by decreasing the flow, you decrease the pressure, you make it more comfortable, and you will be able to assess the effect of high flow, because they are awake, so they can tell you. And it's different from CPAP, from the reason we said it's just expiratory. It doesn't impact on inspiratory flow. But it's a good point. Well, so in a way, I don't know whether you were here at the beginning, but if you see the study I presented at the beginning, they were all ARDS patients. So patients with a PF ratio of less than 300 or 26 kilopascal, most of them, 85%, if I remember correctly, had bilateral infiltrates. Most of them had pneumonia. So by all accounts, there were patients with ARDS. Well, so some of them, the best effect was below 200, so you can say moderate to severe. Now, the question is whether you should use high flow in the severe one. I'll leave that to your discretion. But I think for the moderate is a very good option to start with. Yeah. But I agree with you, but so we need to keep in mind that severe ARDS, if you look at the study with a non-invasive ventilation, 82% of the cases that get intubated. So you've got 80% chances before you start doing anything, they will get intubated. And that's why my diagram, I said, is a judgment call. If the patient is really deteriorating, you think he should be intubated, you shouldn't delay intubation. But for the grey cases when you think, well, a bit of treatment, some high flow, humidified, reduce the work of breathing, you might get them better in moderate ARDS, or then try. But and the results of the clinical trial would support that sort of decision. But clearly, for the, you know, if your PF ratio is 8, quite clearly you need to start doing something. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Extubate on a higher flow and wean down, or extubate on a lower flow and wean up.
No, I think now what we tend to do is we look at the flow that we use, that the patient uses peri-extubation, and we match it. And usually it's actually good. And then you can go up and down as the time goes on. But I think probably the best option at the beginning would be to use slightly higher, because post-extubation, there's a bit more agitation. So the peak inspiratory flow, mean inspiratory flow goes up. The glottis is a little bit more edematous, so you might want higher flow. And it can help with secretions, especially the secretions that peri-extubation. So tend to go a little bit higher and then be guided by the patient. I mean, I don't find that there is a fixed rule, and patient normally will tell you. Yeah, that's I found. Also, the size of the prongs is quite useful to measure to the nostrils. So the sort of bigger ones normally are slightly, they'll give you a better pressure flow relationship than the smaller ones. Unfortunately, you can't change the anatomy of the nose of the patient, but you can do something with the interface. Yeah. Platelet slip. I haven't thought about that, but I assume anything that will allow you to have an NG tube in will be okay. Yeah, yeah. But it's a good point, especially if they scratch a lot. Yeah. I have to say, we've not had many patients severely thrombocytopenic on high flow, but I assume sort of anything like 50 would be a place to start. Yeah. Yeah. How are we doing for time? Time to finish? 10 minutes, okay. So any other experience slightly different from the one I presented? Any dramatic success or dramatic failures? Anything? Yeah, it's a good question. So we are introducing it now. One of my colleagues, Guy Glover, is doing quite a lot of work on this, just to do it on the medical ward. And we are by nature a little bit cautious, so we start with clear indications and also clear indication when to stop it. So we are using a little bit of the diagram I showed you on the ward, but looking at PO, so the ROX index, so SpO2, FiO2 on respiratory rate. And then essentially we have a MET team, like an outreach team, that will review these patients in the first hour, 2 hours, and then every 3 hours. And then if things get better, that's fine. If they continue to deteriorate or remain the same, they can move to a high dependency unit, maybe still on high flow, but where we can monitor a bit more closely. So we want it to be a success, and we don't want early failures. So I think that's... Is that your experience? Yeah. I think as long as you make clear when not to do it, that's the key. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Early coffee then. Okay, thanks very much. Thanks.